It's my privilege to introduce a dear colleague, Dr. Frank Stalfa. Dr. Stalfa holds a master's degree from Master of Divinity degree from Duke Divinity School and a Doctor of Ministry degree from Lancaster Theological Seminary. Frank has taught as an adjunct associate professor and as a clinical assistant professor in various programs of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He is a professional member of the International Enneagram Association, a diplomate of the American Psychotherapy Association, and a National Board certified counselor and a licensed professional counselor in Pennsylvania. From 1974, Frank was employed with the Family Counseling Center, Hillsboro, North Carolina, first as a clinical substance abuse counselor and later in 1977 as director of the center. Frank was named to the faculty of Lancaster Theological Seminary in 1988 to teach pastoral theology and was appointed dean of students in 2006. Frank is an ordained member, minister of Word and Sacrament in the United Church of Christ, as is his wife, Susan Manasian. He is a part-time staff therapist and pastoral counselor with the Samaritan Counseling Center of Lancaster County. This data points to the fact that Frank epitomizes the ideal of the reflective practitioner of ministry. His teaching and research are rooted in the nitty-gritty activities of providing pastoral care. But Frank does more than just do pastoral care. He situates his practice in a much broader context. Frank knows that the one-on-one interactions with students and clients are part of a broader cultural and social ecology. He is not afraid to ask ethical and theological questions about the practice of pastoral care, fully aware that the clinical model must be held accountable to normative considerations embedded in the Christian heritage. I think we're going to be treated to a taste of that ethical reflection this very morning. Now, speaking of situating pastoral care in its cultural context, Frank is one of the most astute movie commentators that I know. And whenever I want a movie to illustrate a theological issue, Frank always has the perfect example. In fact, he usually owns a copy of it. His cinematic taste is exquisitely honed. My only question is, given all that you do, Frank, how do you have time to watch movies? So, envying his obviously spectacular time management skills, it is my honor to introduce Professor and Dean of Students, Dr. Frank Stalfa.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Lee. Thank you. This is one of the reasons why I had to withdraw from Netflix, because the DVDs piled up on a shelf, and I was still paying for them, though I never got around to watching them. So, but I hope to remedy that someday. Well, good morning. And thank you for being here this morning. There was a cartoon in the New Yorker magazine several years ago, a sign over a table in a neighborhood restaurant which reads, "Thank you for not talking about your journey." Now, I think that's a proper reminder for most of us who've been away for a while, especially on a sabbatical journey. So eager are we to tell about our research that most of those who know well refrain from asking the question, "What did you do on your sabbatical?" You know that you only have about 18 seconds to say something intelligible before the eyes of your audience glaze over. Present company excepted, of course. Well, let me say it was good. It was productive. And I do have a few things to share with you that I hope will not result in glazed eyes. Thank you all for taking time out of a very busy week to be here. I'd also like to thank the Board of Trustees for this generous time away from routine duties to think on things that hopefully make a contribution back to this school and my own field of pastoral theology. I also want to express appreciation to my faculty colleagues for stepping in during my absence. Whenever one of us is away on sabbatical, all have to work harder. You have all honored me with the extra effort this has required of you. I would like to thank three others in addition. Dr. Elizabeth Soto and Dr. Perry Hazeltine for ably assisting in my Dean of Students role, and the Reverend Marianne Grabowski, who worked with me in revising the course Ministry with Couples and Families and taught it this last fall with great distinction. Thank you all. Now, every worthy research question is prompted by a problem that needs attention. And so I begin with a brief history of the problem in the field of pastoral care and leadership that I believe has left us with a profound inhibition in raising moral and ethical issues in our pastoral work. I will then describe, again very briefly, some of the newer research in ethical theory, moral psychology, and cognitive neuroscience that may guide our practices as we attempt to venture into this most vexing area of our shared human dilemma. I will then conclude with some theological reflections and specific encouragements as we apply current theories of moral discernment and decision-making to pastoral care, pastoral counseling, and pastoral leadership. I began this sabbatical with the intention to develop a method of inquiry into moral and ethical issues, hence the title of this presentation, Minding What Matters, Moral Inquiry in Pastoral Care. I had hoped to identify one that would provide pastoral leaders with a means to identify and address the often overlooked moral issues that are frequently embedded in the common life dilemmas people bring to us. It didn't take long for me to realize, however, that I didn't yet understand how it is that we actually make moral decisions. Until we better understand the process of making value-laden judgments, what is actually going on inside us as we struggle with competing value claims and imperatives, any method would be arbitrary at best. So my attention turned first to the questions such as, where does morality come from? Is it natural, acquired, learned? Why is it so hard for us to process moral questions and evaluate moral actions? Is there a process we go through to get as close to the truth as possible? If so, what does it look like? A reliable method has to be based on answers to these kinds of questions and also be conversant with the latest research in the field. First, let me define a few of the key terms I'll be using. I'm following Charles Taylor's definition of moral as he describes it in his book, Sources of the Self. He writes, quote, "Moral issues involve discriminations of right and wrong, better or worse, higher or lower, which are not rendered valid by our own desires or choices, but rather stand independent of these and offer standards by which they may be judged," unquote. Now, this definition assumes two things on which there is much contemporary debate. One is that we are responsible for taking on the hard work of moral inquiry, that is, making discriminations. The other is that we are accountable to an ultimate source of value that we do not determine for ourselves. Though we may have different convictions as to the origin and content of that ultimate source, we have an abiding sense that it makes a claim on us, and we are subject to it. Whether it comes from a transcendent source, such as God, or a promise we have made to each other, we are bound to it, and we are measured by it. I distinguish ethical from moral decision-making following a concept offered by ethicist Rushworth Kidder, who sees ethical dilemmas as less concerned with questions accented toward right or wrong than those which seem to pose a right versus right alternative. When decisions need to be made between sound moral options, such as justice or mercy, individual or community, rights or obligations, rather than asking what is the right thing to do, the ethical question is somewhat more nuanced and thus more likely to ask, what is the wiser course to take in this particular situation and why? I have found this to be a very helpful distinction. Trying to apply moral values to ethical dilemmas only complicates that process. By psychological, I am narrowly limiting my view here to how we understand what motivates those, and here I quote Owen Flanagan, those who live above a certain threshold of decency, quote unquote. To be good or fail at our efforts to do so, in terms of what we are actually capable of. It also refers to what goes on inside us and among us as we are formed throughout our life history, in terms of both nature and nurture, consciously and unconsciously. Did you get all that? Okay, good. This spectrum allows for a full appreciation of our strengths and vulnerabilities when it comes to our capacity for moral and ethical discernment. It helps frame the question, what can be expected of finite human beings, or as Flanagan asks the question, creatures like us? Whatever it is must fit our actual human condition, or else our moral standards become a source of shame and failure rather than an inspiration. If God requires us to love our neighbor as ourselves, surely it is because we have been given the potential by God's grace to do so. Now, a brief retrospective analysis of how we got here. There are many ways to describe when and how our pastoral practices gradually drifted away from paying relevant attention to moral and ethical issues, most especially in the Protestant mainline. Although arbitrary in some ways, I date the first and perhaps most ardent distress signal coming from the work of pastoral psychologist and CPE supervisor Paul Preuser. In his 1976 book, The Minister as Diagnostician, he was one of the first to notice with some alarm the tendency for ministers in training to model themselves after their colleagues in psychology and social work, often vying with them to demonstrate their expertise in the psychotherapeutic arts. I was one of them. As a result, Preuser proclaimed they sacrifice their birthright as bearers of the holy and practitioners of sacred presence in the lives of those who sought their counsel. Here is a representative example of his critique, which is almost also a lament. He writes, and I quote, "I am convinced that a great many persons who turn to their pastors for help in solving personal problems seek assistance in some kind of religious or moral self-evaluation. They want some criteria of their faith applied to themselves. They may not be able to say so outright. They may not know how to phrase their wish, hoping that their pastor will make the first move. Some may wish to pray, if only the pastor would do so. Some may wish to be blessed, if only their pastor would be so inclined. Others may wish to be decisively confronted with their failings or disloyalties, if only their pastor had the forthrightness to do so." Unquote. His point is that in our zeal to master and integrate the psychological knowledge and therapeutic skills, we may have inadvertently removed ourselves from the one place our people need us most. They come to us, as opposed to a clinical practitioner, for instance, because we are perceived to represent the moral dimension of life, grounded in our faith traditions and communal practices, and most especially in the gospel. What they need and what we give, without intending to do a disservice to them, often doesn't get to the heart of the matter. We have gradually become purveyors of psychological insight, as good and worthy as it is, while quite often the moral evaluation of which Preusser speaks has gone unacknowledged. Almost every problem brought to the attention of religious leaders contains a covert moral dimension. But we often miss it because it is not expressed in those terms. Think about the last conflict you had with someone, or a question about whether or not to stay in a troubled relationship. Perhaps you were trying to decide how best to navigate a power struggle in your family or organization, or how to manage your anger or guilt or fear. The chances are that you framed the problem in psychological language and you received a therapeutic response. But the values at stake went largely unaddressed. In the healing professions, generally, it seems that the psychological domain has virtually eclipsed the moral landscape. I have a hunch that the cultural context in which this began to happen played a big role in this displacement of pastoral priorities. The status of ministry and the place of the church in society were changing radically and have continued to do so. Those of us just entering ministry at that time were troubled, more deeply than we knew, by a vague sense of obsolescence as the culture grew more secularized and institutional religion more irrelevant in the lives of so many people. A profound need for professional respectability and social acceptance began to shape pastoral practices in decisive ways. Perhaps we did not knowingly capitulate to a culture of individualism, personal freedom, and self-fulfillment, but in an effort to keep ourselves relevant and useful, the therapeutic skills that were meant to augment pastoral care instead became its centerpiece. The result, which continues today, is a powerful collusion with our parishioners and clients to avoid offending those who come to us with serious moral issues by reverting to contemporary therapeutic discourse, rather than inquiring as well about values and consequences and character. Along the way, we have also lost the art of how to do this, how best to raise morally sensitive issues, how best to integrate morality and psychology and spiritual wisdom, how best to tolerate within ourselves the temporary distress and dismay of leaving someone we really care about to struggle with worthy questions of the good, the right, and the true, as they best know how, while being quite upset with us for having burdened them with that sacred work. They may well leave us, as did the rich young ruler, when he did not get the answer he wanted, but deeply needed, sorrowful rather than inspired. No wonder our people need it, and yet we avoid it. A few thoughts on some new contributions, especially from the fields of moral psychology and neuroscience. Those of us in the Hebrew Christian tradition have an invaluable inheritance of moral and ethical wisdom to draw on. But for the most part, our formal education in philosophical and theological ethics comes to us at a high degree of abstraction. We learn the grand theories, the teleological, the deontological, the utilitarian, virtue and care-based approaches, among others. They teach us how to think about what constitutes the good and why it is good. But most of it is very difficult to translate from such a lofty theoretical level into the complicated life situations that cause us moral confusion. With good intention, we try to apply the various principles of these theories to the moral dilemmas we face, hoping to find a satisfactory resolution. Somewhat like a decision tree, we begin by identifying our values, then applying them to the problem, and consequently arrive at a satisfactory resolution. Many of our efforts to do moral inquiry are based on this very approach, but we are constantly and inevitably disappointed in the results for reasons that are now becoming clearer to us. In his Caris Lectures, Alastair McIntyre makes an interesting observation about the disjuncture of moral theory and real-life human agency. He writes, "In most moral philosophy, the starting point is one that already presupposes the existence of a mature, independent, practical reasoner, whose social relationships are the relationships of the adult world. But practical reasoners enter the adult world with relationships, experiences, attitudes, and capacities that they bring with them from childhood and adolescence, and that always to some degree, and often to some very large degree, they are unable to discard and disown." Unquote. I would offer that it is helpful to say "we" here rather than "they." So the first insight worth emphasizing here is that our very capacity for facing and resolving moral dilemmas, as well as helping others to do so, is already greatly conditioned by our personal histories, our level of relative maturity over time, as well as unresolved legacies of trauma, betrayal, and abuse. Moral psychologist Owen Flanagan, to whom I've referred earlier, has called this disposition minimal psychological realism. Moral ideals and the capacity for realizing them must be grounded in the actual life of persons. Moral decision-making is not a separate activity of the will or conscience, no matter how well informed we may be about espoused values and stated convictions. The evidence is that our aptitude for moral discernment is only weakly influenced by the norms to which we are exposed and the rational efforts we make to apply them. We arrive at our own moral quandaries already deeply constituted in a certain way and strongly predisposed to make decisions that are consistent with the good as best we are able to know it. It is the whole person, one's entire history, culture, and personality that must be taken into consideration as we attempt to address the moral choices and actions set before us. Though we have erred significantly in our tendency to evade moral problems in pastoral practice by psychologizing them, neither can we rightly approach complex moral issues without understanding the person before us whose life history has inscribed the resources of their moral education up to that point in time. Moral decision-making is indeed the shared work of one's whole self in relationship with others. We cannot approach the task as moral guides as though it only requires us to give moral advice, or even worse, admonish those who fall short of admirable behavior. Moral discernment is a process, one that has to be taken in, often suffered over, and finally claimed by those who will have to live with the choices they make. And sometimes, perhaps more than sometimes, failure is the best moral teacher we have. Many of us watched the recent interview by Oprah Winfrey with disgraced cyclist Lance Armstrong. Whatever you thought of the sincerity of his confession of wrongdoing and his betrayal of friends, it is possible to see that his moral education could only begin as a result of a profound humiliation, one that forced him to begin the work of moral self-examination. At one point, he observes that he was, quote-unquote, a jerk and a humanitarian at the same time. Saint and sinner, both, as Luther might say. This reminds us that it is never too late to start the process of moral self-evaluation, and often it comes only after we have transgressed so egregiously that we have no other path than the one of confession and repentance to set us right. And by the way, Miss Winfrey is not bad at the art of moral inquiry. The next insight I'd share with you today is from the research of Jonathan Haidt in his highly regarded book, The Righteous Mind, and we all have righteous minds. His is a multicultural study of what he calls the seven moral foundations he finds in almost all the cultural traditions he has examined. There are many things to say here, but I would emphasize only a few that help us make sense out of the difficulty we have applying values directly to problems. The first is that in his studies of how we actually make complex moral discriminations, he has found that deep intuitive reactions tend to be the most determinative. He believes that when people work through moral dilemmas, we tend to draw on powerful emotional convictions that are inherently pre-rational and largely innate. We operate from intuition first, and we reason second. What his social psychological research shows is that the initial exercise of reason is what he calls strategic. That is almost always defensive, and what he refers to as a post hoc fabrication. A post hoc fabrication. It confirms and corroborates the original moral intuition. It does not and usually cannot analyze or challenge the highly charged emotional response that leads us to make important decisions. Haidt uses the metaphor of the rider and the elephant. The rider is the reasoning mind. The elephant is our highly conditioned, emotional, intuitive disposition. Everything in us that has a gut-level certitude about what feels right, as well as what we've been told and taught. The rider only appears to be controlling the elephant, but it is in reality mostly only leaning the way the elephant is already going. And we cannot, in that moment, tell the difference on our own because this rider mind thinks it is in charge, thinks it's in control, properly assessing and applying the moral priorities that makes the most sense to us. It should not surprise us, then, that resistance to truth-telling is so high at the beginning of the process. And we all start here. Most recent studies in cognitive neuroscience have corroborated moral and social psychology on this very point. It is only in the last 10 years or so that neurophysiologists have been able to look inside the brain in real time to observe the neurochemical activity taking place when people are presented with moral and ethical dilemmas to work through. The results are quite humbling and inspiring for different reasons. First, we need to see how immediate we see how immediate and instantaneous neuronal activity is when we are struggling with moral conundrums. Once again, it is the emotional center of the brain, not the thinking center, that is fully mobilized first. The evidence so far suggests that our brains make up our minds before we are even aware of what we consciously think. By the time we do become conscious of a decision or a position, it has already been settled and can only be defended because it feels so deeply and incontrovertibly true to us. As neuroscientist Michael Gazzaniga describes in his book, The Ethical Brain, The Science of Our Moral Dilemmas, quote, neuroscience tells us by the time any of us consciously experience something, the brain has already done its work. When we become consciously aware of making a decision, the brain has already made it happen, unquote. No wonder, then, that both the pastoral leader trying her best to generate moral self-examination and the conflicted person in front of her who mightily resists her efforts so easily become frustrated with each other. This is where we should expect the process to begin. Denial, rationalization, and evasion. This is why Haidt believes that the only way to correct this is to subject ourselves to what he calls the next step in the process, reasoned persuasion. The reasoned persuasion of trusted others. We have to open ourselves up to the moral consciousness of those who care about our well-being enough to confront us with our tendency to protect our self-image and our self-interest by evading the truth we cannot see all on our own. Only then can we receive their counsel and challenge, helping us to adjust our own biased and deeply conditioned disposition to see things a certain way. Haidt concludes that a solitary moral conscience is rare among us, although the capacity for moral introspection does help, and that most of us simply cannot make our best moral discrimination apart from a community who teaches us, guides us, and holds us accountable. Moral decision-making, he insists, is at best an interdependent practice because we are incapable of overcoming our inherent tendency to rationalize what we want to believe and justify it to ourselves. At some primal level, it feels connected to our very survival. No wonder how earnestly we can defend our initial convictions, how distorted our self-understanding can be. But once our confusions and convictions are out in the open, where our initial post hoc reasoning is exposed with just the right amount of challenge and support, we have a greater chance of participating in collective moral discernment. It is important to emphasize, however, that one's moral intuition, though incomplete, is also indispensable. In many people, it operates with a keen and immediate sensitivity to the well-being of others, part of our aspirational drive to help others, even at expense to ourselves. In January of 2007, a New York construction worker by the name of Wesley Autry saw a stranger suddenly fall onto the subway tracks as the train rounded the bend at full speed. He immediately dove down, placing his body on top of the stranger's just as the train passed over both of them. When interviewed later about his act of self-sacrificial bravery, He replied, "I don't feel like I did anything spectacular. I just saw someone who needed help. I did what I felt was right." The brave Mr. Autry could say it this way because our intuition is quite often deeply morally informed as part of our biological inheritance. No one would argue that he had the time to do anything resembling moral discernment. His was a spontaneous act of moral courage. It is not unusual for others who have engaged in such acts to say things like, "I couldn't have lived with myself if I had not tried to save him." Or, "It almost felt like I was the one on the tracks." It does not feel selfless in the moment. It feels natural, reflexive, and absolutely necessary. And it is. Again, the latest neurocognitive research helps us to understand this important aspect of our moral capacity. Deep in the limbic midbrain, neuroscientists have discovered so-called mirror neurons, which actually simulate the pain we perceive in others as though it were our own. MRI brain studies have allowed research to identify this process in infants as young as 3 months old and document consistent altruistic behavior at 18 months of age, regardless of the child's parental influence or family environment. The implications here are heartening, if not conclusive. What if we are born to be empathic, to register internal distress when seeing others in harm's way? What if we are predisposed toward altruism from our earliest stages of development? What if our innate capacity for goodness exists side by side with the drive for self-preservation and protection of our own self-interest? Then perhaps we have warrant to suppose that the inclination toward the good is truly available to us and can be brought forth with wise and patient effort if we but take the risk to do so. Preuser tells us that the troubled person before us is waiting for us to take the initiative, hoping that we will make the first move. But will we? A few implications for theological and pastoral practices. In the brief time remaining, I'm only able to put the possible implications of this research into a few propositional statements that I think deserve more attention. The first of which would be that I found nothing in the contemporary research of moral decision-making that would contradict the classical Christian view of the divided and contradicted self. We human beings are, in the words of the hymn, "Oh, how glorious, full of wonder, a mixture strange of good and ill." Sometimes we emphasize one at the expense of the other, but the classical Christian tradition at its best strives to balance our capacity for good with the sad reality that we so often fail in our efforts to achieve it. If the current research on moral decision-making is a worthwhile guide, it is because it corroborates so much of what we already know theologically about human nature. It assumes that there is an innate capacity for good, much like Jeremiah's Yahweh, who says, "I will set my law within them, writing it on their hearts." The moral law is in there, in us, and can be trusted to exert its power, whether through guilt and confession when we fail, or gratitude when we are able to live up to our ideals. In conclusion, then, I invite us to consider the following encouragements. We need to cultivate the art of listening for the covert and often deeply embedded moral issues at the heart of the problems that aren't presented to us that way. If Preuser is correct, our people depend on us to make that the center rather than the periphery of our concerns. Two, Sometimes this will mean a highly nuanced exploration of one's moral terrain, using Rebecca Miles' term, without being so heavy-handed about what we think the person should or should not do. But there are other times when it will require a more assertive, even interventionary insistence that they stop what they're doing, because the potential for violation and endangerment is so high. We do on occasion confront evil, and we need to speak to it with personal and prophetic courage. Three, we need a pedagogy in order to learn how to do this well. Otherwise, moral inquiry and pastoral care will be left to those who have a natural disposition for it, while leaving the rest to muddle through as best we can. It is an art and a discipline in its own right, and it needs to be taught as part of our curriculum. It is difficult, very, very difficult to do well, and we need the training to develop this expertise. Next, if height is correct, truth-telling is very hard, and we should not expect ourselves to arrive at it without struggle. Even people of sufficient integrity and goodwill cannot readily see the limitations of their intuitive convictions without going through strenuous rationalization first. What initially looks like evasion of moral responsibility may be the only true path to it. We need to be patient. Five, moral inquiry and discernment is a communal activity not best left to us to do in isolation. The solitary moral conscience is unlikely to get much beyond self-justification. It is where we all start from. We need to be compassionate with each other. Six, if the neuroscience is accurate, we are all subject to forces that predispose us to both self-serving ends as well as acts of great sacrifice, self-sacrifice. The capacity for good and evil exists side by side within us as a given of our human nature. And it is finally empathy, not reason, that creates conscience. It is empathy, not reason, that creates conscience. We need to practice this every day. Seven, we should take the whole person, one's history, personality, and culture and context into consideration when dealing with moral discernment. Ignore the sign over the table and ask about the journey, the one that has brought a person to a moral impasse, the one that requires a deeper confrontation with the inevitable conflict between desire and obligation, values and action. We need to be holistic. Let us not disqualify ourselves from moral inquiry because of our own past moral failings and ethical struggles. In the moment of need, it is not about us, but those who entrust us with this sacred work. We need to be present for each other. And then last, when it comes to moral courage, especially in speaking up in the public square for justice and peace and liberation, find your own moral exemplar. Someone who demonstrates with their life what it means to live out your ideals with integrity. Be it a Martin Luther King Jr., Cesar Chavez, a Harriet Tubman, a Desmond Tutu, an Aung San Suu Kyi, or someone known only to you, study that life. Study it as a locus of virtue and a biography of moral formation. That way, when the time comes for each of us to face our own moral dilemmas and help others with theirs, we have a mentor, a living human witness to what it means to love our neighbor as ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank, for that very powerful lecture. I think we all have something to think about, and many things to think about in response to your words. We have time for a few questions, and I'll be glad to bring the microphone back to you if somebody has. Want to start?
Sure. I'd like to put in a good word for ethical meta-reflection. And I'm wondering about your appeal to empathy, which I'm fully in sympathy with, but
I'm glad
I'm empathic about it. But aren't there times when you need to step back and use moral reflection to evaluate and critique various kinds of empathy? I'm thinking about I had a conversation with a career soldier who said that he experienced deep moral commitment and profound empathy with the members of his company, his band of brothers, and that he would kill civilians for them if he thought it was necessary. So there's a kind of empathy, and that's not self-preservation versus empathy.
Right.
That's one kind of empathy for your immediate tribe,
right,
as over against empathy for folk from a broader human community. So aren't there times when you just have to step back and ask the question, is our empathy or my empathy, is that appropriate?
Oh, I agree. I think there's misplaced empathy that has to be lifted up as a moral problem. I mean, a typical situation for many of us here is working with an abused spouse who has far too much empathy for her abuser. You know, we use this love your neighbor as yourself. I think people operate on one side or the other of that divide sometimes. They need more self-love because they have an excess of what looks like neighbor love anyway, an over identification with the person who's injuring them. And I think challenging that as a disservice to themselves is very, very important. In the case you raise here, I think also this idea of killing others, his love for others, therefore validating an act of taking another life, certainly deserves to be lifted up as a possible instance of misplaced or exaggerated empathy as a moral issue. So I would agree.
Thank you. So I'm also, hi, Dr. Sofa.
Hello.
Naomi.
I've got a little bit of glare, Naomi. Go ahead.
I'm struck by your argument, and I'm convinced by it, but I too have a question related to the nuance of it all. When individuals gather to form institutions and groups, and those institutions and groups create systems, how does this approach change when it seems that the system has its own kind of moral conscience that is outside of the control of any one individual? How do we hold the system accountable? Because it seems like problems arise because it's bigger than individuals.
Yes.
Somehow individuals get corrupted by the systems. So
exactly. Well, that's great. You know, I wish I had had time to take my thinking to the systemic political economic level. I'm not smart enough to do that, but that's where we need to go with this, because when you live in systems that are unjust, that oppress, leave out the voices of the people who have deserved to be heard, then you're dealing with structural evil. And that's internalized, and then it gets manifested in the people who belong to that system. And it may be why that systems and organizations have a greater time having a moral center than individuals do. The bigger the group, the more potential there is for rivalry, competition, and all of those other nasty things that get set in. And when you have a philosophy of that the way that group operates, its core values are not just, then it's almost like it infiltrates everybody's functioning in that group. And that's where the prophet comes in, I think. That's where the prophetic voice comes in, someone who can stand sometimes alone and speak truth to power to the inequities of the system. So that's very much a part of this whole issue of moral discernment. We have to bring it up to the public and political level at times. The issue now with gun control, major moral debate going on in this country between rights and obligations, between libertarian you know, this is my right, communitarian, what's best for the social order, and the clash of values there. So we're going to see a lot of this continuing. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank, for sharing this wisdom with us. And I'm thinking along some lines like Naomi's, but from a different end. I'm thinking about the implications of what you're sharing with us for evangelism and ecclesiology. What's the role of a community if the elephant is so strong and none of us as individuals are good riders of our elephant? What's the role of a community and our need for a community that helps us to shape those base dispositions through relationships and practices?
Yes, that's a great question. The only way I can think it through right now is that I can see how you're riding your elephant better than you can, because I'm not on it. It's not my elephant, but I can't see my own. So that's where you have this secondary process that Haidt talks about, of this collective communal engagement, because we simply can't see ourselves clearly. I'm under the illusion that I'm controlling the elephant, and I know how I believe and why I believe, and I can document it and all that stuff. But the fact is that I am not able to see my biases. I'm not able to see how my fears and insecurities are interfering with greater moral clarity. But you might be able to see it, because you're not in the dilemma with me. Does that help? Okay, yeah.
Frank, thank you for a really very wise and powerful set of reflections that have me thinking about a lot of things. One of them, and maybe in response to Naomi's question too, is that I think it's an extremely strong argument for why we need a diverse seminary, where we have people who come out of different systems of church, different cultures, that helps each of us to identify some aspects of our elephant that we're riding. And so while it's often hard and conflicted when we get into conversations where our values may clash, I think it's incredibly important and a very powerful form of ministerial formation. Absolutely. That happens because of that. And it also gives us the reason why it's so important pedagogically that we create space for ongoing conversations, why that pedagogy has to create space for dialogue with one another. The other question I had was about research that shows that most people that go into pastoral ministry are very averse to conflict. And so, you know, what can we do to try to help ourselves to find the courage to deal with the conflict that comes with helping someone to describing another person's elephant?
Right. That's part of the art, I think, that we have to teach each other. How you do it is as important as what you do. The two go together so exquisitely, you know. And I think that's where we need a lot more help to learn how to do these things. But tolerating, as I mentioned in here, tolerating the pushback, tolerating the rejection is very, very important. We are so eager to be liked and loved and needed by our people that we are wary of saying anything that's going to get you upset with me. Now, not everybody's that way. We have a fair number of students here who are much better at weathering backlash if they take a self-defined position, for instance, much better than I am. And, you know, I really admire that. So people who are not so good at that need to simply get stronger. It's like practicing resilience, a certain kind of resilience in yourself that can weather the reactivity of people when you ask them to think about how their values and their actions are related. And even some in stronger terms, again, where there's something that needs to stop, where harm is being done, being strong enough to take that stand is simply absolutely necessary. But I don't think you can be a good leader without that either. I mean, it's necessary in this level of pastoral counseling, to be sure, but I don't think you can be a leader and a pleaser. I think those two are really, really in tension with each other. And you're right, many of us come into ministry because we want to be close to people and have people like us and take care of them. And that's simply an insufficient model for ministry. Even caregiving ministry, the caregiving part, it's insufficient. But it certainly is insufficient for leadership.
Dr. Stauffer, I wanted to just, the practice, I think that we need to introduce the practice at an earlier age in our junior, senior, high school, and young adult about speaking the truth with love and respect. Because so much of the time our knee-jerk reaction is to call somebody out. And so can you speak to the practice of teaching that earlier in our lives?
Well, I would agree. I mean, I hope a lot of this happens in our church communities from, you know, baptism on up. I mean, that's where the moral formation takes place at its best, I think. But then you move outside the religious community setting and into the school system. There used to be a big push years and years ago on values clarification. How many of you remember that? You remember the hue and cry against it? The pushback you got from a lot of the culture at that time that we don't want people in school telling our children how to decide what's right or what's good. We'll teach that at home. Same thing you get with sex education in many ways. But I couldn't agree with you more. That's where it ought to be done. Education ought to be a place where we're encountering these things, both in the theoretical and the experiential level.
We have one last question.
I was wondering if you could give us an example from your own practice of how your pastoral care has changed as a result of what you've learned.
I think I'm much keener, not that I'm good, but I'm much keener at listening for the covert moral dilemma in the, let's just call it, psychosocial problematic that people bring into the consulting room, so to speak. And trying to get a sense of how to raise that in a sensitive but hopefully impactful way. I really do think I've been sensitized and challenged by this research to listen in a different way and try to find a language, try to find an idiom that lifts that up in a way that the person can receive. If the person doesn't receive it, it's hardly ever worth it. Sometimes you have to say it anyway, because it has to be said, it has to be out there, the witness has to be out there. But I've also learned that if we can't find a way to say it well, it's counterproductive. That's part of the art. But I can definitely say I have been sensitized to, is there a covert moral dilemma in this particular problem? Are there value issues at stake? And if so, can we talk about them too? So it's helped me become much more sensitive to that in my work.